It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station, FM 107.1. And joining us this afternoon, we have Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins, eponymously named Harvell and Collins. I always like to use that word eponymous whenever I can. And with that, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Lockwood.
Thank you for having us. Lockwood, we thought maybe we would introduce some topics that just are kind of common questions that arise all the time in the estate context, which is, you know, about taxes. The ever-present word taxation.
Right.
And interestingly, there's just a lot of misnomer and misunderstanding about taxes in an estate. And we really do need to make sure our listeners are up to speed on this. As we all know, there are different types of taxes, Lockwood. Mm-hmm. There's income tax. There's capital gain tax. Yes, there is estate tax under certain circumstances, which we're about to discuss. But we always have to begin our talk about taxes in terms of, well, which tax are you talking about? And so let's just go right out of the gate with estate tax. Now, estate tax has been something that has just changed continually over and over again. Some of our listeners are still thinking that it's at $600,000. If you have assets beyond $600,000, there's estate tax in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not accurate anymore, Lockwood. The estate tax has escalated up to, believe it or not, as high as just a bit over $11 million per individual. So it's somewhat rare to have estates that generate estate tax because they are that they're just, you know, not necessarily that many folks. It's a very low percentage in our country of folks that would have an estate that triggers the $11 million figure. So estate tax is really high now in terms of the exemption equivalent, mm-hmm. and it's just not something that we usually are dealing with.
Once those taxes or all the estates are distributed, does that then become part of an individual's normal income? And do they then have to record that in their annual statements, which, of course, now are due in just a few weeks, April 15th. It's April 18th, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, April 18th. So the estate doesn't have a lot of taxes, but what about the individuals who are the recipients of the estate?
Our federal government and our state government has to have that tax dilemma figured out a long time ago, Lockwood,
okay.
Which is they're not going to wait for the recipient to receive their inheritance. They're going to take it off the top at the estate side. And if and when there's something left, then we will let it distribute to the beneficiary. Oh. So the answer to your question is that there is no tax at the beneficiary level. The estate has to pay the tax.
Okay.
The executor and or administrator is responsible for seeing that the estate tax return is filed and paying the tax, if you will, outside of the out of the estate proceeds, and then net give the proceeds to the beneficiaries.
Okay. So in a lot of instances, and we've talked about this in the past, a situation where someone's saying, okay, well, I need to, eliminate some of my assets so as not to have any kind of a major income tax, estate tax bill. In many instances, then you're telling me that that is rare in light of the fact that the threshold is close to $11 million and that's per person, right?
Correct.
Wow.
That is correct.
So, all right, if I understand that correctly, then if somebody has no one of this nature, but has, say, $22 million estate, and it's going to be distributed among three people, am I to understand that those that you divide that 22 by the number three?
No. The estate tax is is per estate.
Okay. All right. Okay.
So there would be 11 million plus. It's a little bit over 11 million for the benefit of, let's say, for instance, the wife, and then there would be another 11 million for the husband, for a total of 22 million for that family.
Okay. All right. I
see. Those numbers are extraordinarily high, Lockwood, and our listeners are I can assure you that they are really surprised to hear those numbers, because most folks just simply do not know that. And this is a real taxes has always been one of the three fears of settling the estate.
Right.
You know, what are the costs going to be? What are the taxes are going to be? And what is the timeline going to be? But the tax issue, estate tax, and by the way, estate tax is the same as inheritance tax, death tax. All of these are synonymous for the same thing, and they are at that $11 million plus figure at this point.
Right. And, of course, we've heard that term before, a death tax. All right. The other question goes back to who's responsible for this? Who oversees all of these estate matters and these taxes? Particularly in an instance where someone, and I know it's probably going to fall to the executor, but, you know, the executor may not have the capacity to handle all the estate matters, particularly when it comes to taxes, because that is a, you know, that really is a very complex issue in some instances.
Well, any issue like this, you know, Lockwood, would fall to the lawyer who's helping the executor with the settlement of the estate. The accounting team that may be in place or usually is in place in a file that would trigger estate tax. But if not, we certainly get an accounting team in place. At our office, we're very fortunate to have Andrew Foster as a member of our team at Harvell and Collins. And, of course, Andrew has the LLM in taxation. So we piece it all together. Let's move here a minute, though, Lockwood, so we make some good progress today. We've talked now about estate tax.
Right.
And the bottom line is that estate tax hits very few estates.
Right.
Wes, of course, is completely up to speed on what we call the step-up in basis. And I'm going to let Wes now tell us all about we're shifting gears now to the capital gain tax, not estate tax, but capital gain tax on estates and this concept of a step-up in basis.
You know, Lockwood, where this comes into play more often than not is really in our elder law practice. We deal with folks quite often, you know, we're kind of on one end of the spectrum that Cecil just talked about, where we have large estates that we're dealing with, and we deal with estates that are large, small, anywhere in between. And that's really become more prevalent in the past, I'd say, 5 or 6 years, because the requirements of an estate administration by the state of North Carolina, as far as the detail that's required, is much more stringent than it used to be.
Really?
So we oftentimes have situations where folks maybe even try to start the administration, things get, so to speak, messed up, and they have to then come in and seek an attorney to help them finish it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one end of the spectrum when we're talking about large estates. But again, we deal with all type of estates. On the other end of the spectrum, in many cases, we're dealing with another attack on folks' estates when they're living. First attack being estate taxes. The second one being the cost of long-term care.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about that before on the program on several occasions. And, you know, in many cases, the primary asset that we're dealing with and the clients are interested in holding on to is the home.
Right.
Okay, so if you're not careful when we're talking about protecting the home place from a long-term care spend down, you can trigger a tax that you don't know about until later. For example, if let's say that there's a transfer of the home to the kids, there's just what we call just a simple, maybe quick claim deed, everything goes to the kids. Okay, I've taken care of it, property's in the name of the kids. You know, as long as I wait 5 years, I don't have to worry about the home.
Right.
Well, that's not the best plan. And there's many reasons we can talk about why that's not the best plan, but let's focus on just the tax issue since that's what we're talking about today. By transferring that home place to the children, you've also transferred the tax basis. Okay, let's say that mom and dad bought the property for $100,000 years ago. They've transferred that property to the children now at their tax basis of $100,000. So in the event that the children sell the home, this would be after mom and dad have passed away, then the tax basis will be $100,000. And let's say they sell it for $500,000. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, there's a capital gain or a gain of $400,000. The difference between the transferred basis of $100,000, mm-hmm. and then the fair market value or the sales price. So then the tax on that would be the capital gains tax, which would be somewhere in the 20% to 25% wow. range. So that's a $100,000 mistake.
Right.
Okay. Now, if you contrast that with transferring the property using the mechanism that we use, which is basically a transfer of a remainder interest using a specific type of trust and retaining a life estate, you get the same benefit, well, really a better benefit, because the way we do it, there's not a 5-year look back period. Mm-hmm. The home is immediately protected. You're not subjecting the property to the twists and turns of the children's lives, liability, car accident, divorce, bankruptcy, things that can happen in people's lives. We're protecting the home. And then we've gotten a full step up in tax basis upon the death of the last of mom and dad. So how does that work? The way we structure the property allows for the property to be completely protected, but then upon the death of the last of mom or dad, the property then passes to the children or whomever they want it to pass to in their estate planning documents, but under this scenario, the children, and they get it at the day-to-death value. Well, the day-to-death value would probably be $500,000 because that's how much we're selling it for. So what's the gain on $500,000? If that's the basis that was transferred and the sales price is $500,000, there's no gain, so no tax.
Okay, we're talking about, in this case, a remainder trust. I want to get to that in a moment. I want to remind folks, our guest this afternoon, actually a program this afternoon, with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And that number, by the way, for easy access, 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050, or online at harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, please, harvellandcollins.com. Wes, back to that topic of the remainder trust. I know that you and Cecil said this on numerous occasions, you don't develop trust unless there's a real purpose. And of course, we talked about this in relationship to estate taxes and the fact that estates now, the tax really doesn't kick in until you reach the threshold of approximately $11 million. So I want to go back to that remainder trust, and it was something that caught my attention. It gives the primaries, I'll use that description, mother, father, lifetime access to this particular capital asset. In this case, it's a house. Am I correct
right.
on that?
Yes.
So, but the remainder trust, it basically is putting the house in a. I'll use the word bubble. Am I correct on that?
And right. And well, when I since you said bubble, when I diagram this out, the trust is a box.
Okay.
So basically, the asset that you're transferring is going into a box, if we want to conceptualize that visually.
Okay.
It's in its own separate box. So, yeah, go ahead.
A separate legal entity, also
right.
the box.
Okay.
Lockwood, the box is a separate legal entity than, you know, John and Mary Jones.
Okay.
John and Mary Jones own their home individually. We're going to take it out of their individual names and put it in the box, which is a separate legal entity, which is their trust.
Once it's in that box, then how does, I'm intrigued that, you know, it's sort of in limbo, are you going to use that description? And so when the parents pass away, when they die, that box is then transferred, I guess, over to the trust or to the family, I shouldn't say that, to the estate. And so it's transferred at the value at that moment, in other words.
Correct. And the reason it is because we've retained a life estate
okay.
in the name of mom and dad,
uh-huh.
which mom and dad should like because that keeps the kids from kicking mom or dad out of their own home.
Right.
Which you would believe, you would think would never happen. But believe me, things like that happen, and we end up having to deal with those things sometimes because of mistakes.
Well, things like that also, I want to just add, if I may, Lockwood, can happen involuntarily.
Right.
I mean, what if the son or the daughter, you know, have a bankruptcy? What if they have a little 2 or 3 year old child dart out in front of them at the Walmart parking lot?
Uh-huh.
What if they all of a sudden have $1 million liability?
Yeah.
Now the parent's home could potentially be subject to the liabilities. We call it at the law firm, and Wes all uses these words too, the twists and turns of life relative to your children, even their divorces,
Ooh.
Their illnesses,
right.
their cancers, their bankruptcies, their liabilities. So when you deed your home to your children, not only are you creating a tax consequence, a capital gain tax consequence that is negative, not
mm-hmm.
good,
right.
you are also making your home now subject, if you will, to the twists and turns of the life
right.
of your children.
Right. Okay.
The trust avoids all of that, by the way. I mean, the trust of being a separate legal entity can't, you know, have a little child dart out in front of it at Walmart
right,
or,
right,
you know,
right.
have a bankruptcy
right.
or have a divorce. The trust is a separate legal entity, and that's why we advise that for our good clients.
That's Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins with us this afternoon, and we're talking about, well, estate taxes and estate matters. I have a weird question, and I apologize for this in advance. We're talking about this in relationship to a home. What about in a situation associated with, say, a business or something of that nature? Is it conceivable to establish, to put a business in an estate, a remainder trust of some nature? That's a really probably a weird question, but I'm just curious.
Well, yes, you can. It depends on the circumstances.
Uh-huh.
The scenario with regard to protecting the home, I bring that up because that is
the standard.
That is pretty standard.
Right.
I mean, most people, when mm-hmm. mom or dad are having a health issue or they're getting on up in age, and most folks know that if you end up in a skilled nursing facility, it can be incredibly expensive, and there's
right.
some
mm-hmm.
things that can be done to protect the home. They mm-hmm. kind of know that. They just don't know how to do it the right way.
Right.
But we have situations of all kind of permutations. I mean, we have
wow.
situations where folks have, you know, mom and pop businesses, and they have the stock in the business. They have an LLC,
mm-hmm.
or they have, you know, whatever assets they've saved. They might have a retirement account. They might have income, you know, military income from a military pension, from
right.
whatever it may be. So we deal with all these type things. But yes, if the plan would dictate putting the stock into a trust for a purpose to benefit the family, then that's something that
okay.
we would recommend. But one of the things we never recommend is dumping assets into a trust or putting a trust in place or, so to speak, selling a trust to someone when they don't really need it.
Right.
We say that all the time. That, you know, if you go, let's say, and we said this on the program before, if you go Google, when do I need a trust, and we see that come back on the internet, what you're going to get is a national, nationwide type opinion or nationwide websites with regard to that. And what you're going to see is that the most prevalent use of trust in the United States is to avoid the expense of probate.
Right.
Okay, and that is something that may be very useful in certain states, Florida, New York, New Jersey, some of these states where
uh-huh.
probate is really expensive. We don't do that here in North Carolina because we're lucky that in North Carolina it doesn't cost as much to die.
Right.
You know, the probate expense isn't very high
uh-huh.
As far as what the state charges for probate itself, so there's no need to put every, you know, one of our clients into a trust.
Uh-huh.
But if we have a long-term health care need, or we have a client who's concerned about protecting their assets, or we have a special needs child, or we have a child who maybe has, even adult child, who maybe has had a history of drug issues, and we don't want to leave an inheritance. that person directly because we're afraid that they might, you know, might be, they might not be able to manage it well mm-hmm. because right. of their dependencies. You know, that's three or four things. I mean, there's dozens of reasons that we would recommend using a trust, but we're not going to just say, okay, dump everything in the trust because we think it might help you in some way. No, we're going to be much more surgical about the way we do things and make sure that every I is dotted and T is crossed. And there won't be a trust in your plan unless there's a specific reason as to why
okay.
we need one. But your question was about can you use, as you said, a remainder trust to hold a business? Yeah, you can. But we're gonna back into that by there being a reason for it, not just
okay.
doing it.
All right. You know, we're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. That was Wes Collins just a moment ago about the issue of estate planning and estate taxes. And part of that conversation, of course, goes to this topic of protecting the assets for all parties. And one way is to do that, as we've just heard, is through a remainder trust. And I just want to make comment once again. Cecil, you have said, and Wes as well, but there's, as you just said a moment ago, you only establish a trust when there's a true benefit, benefit to the estate, to all members of the estate.
That's absolutely right, Lockwood. I mean, you know, Harvell and Collins, we kind of are known as trust and estates lawyers.
Right.
Wes, of course, primarily heads up our litigation department, but many times his litigation can be related to an estate. It isn't always that way, mm-hmm. but sometimes it is, most times maybe. The bottom line is that as a trust lawyer, the first thing that I tell a client is, what is the purpose right. of your trust? What are we going to hang our hat on?
Mm-hmm.
We don't need to create a trust just for the sake of saying we've done it. There needs to be a very legitimate purpose for you as our client to create a trust. And so let's discuss what that purpose would be. Wes did just rattle off a lot of the purposes, you know, a handicapped child, special needs child, of course, children who are of minor age, spendthrift children who maybe are of adult age but have issues, you know, and then tax reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And then protect your asset reasons. So there are different types of trust for different purposes, and our duty at Harvell and Collins is to listen carefully to the facts of the client, listen to their objectives, their wants, if you will, their desires, their concerns, and then structure a plan that's individualized to their particular needs and objectives, and to put their plan in effect so as to, you know, take these objectives and needs, you know, off the table so that they're honored. And this is just very important, and it can vary greatly from client to client what the needs and objectives are. But at the end of the file, we have strived diligently together to accomplish those objectives.
You know, the aspect of protecting that asset and the benefit of all the parties, I think, is important. Again, we're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins, Harvell and Collins. And I just want to remind you, the number, 252 area code, 726-9050. That's 252 area code, 726-9050. Or go online to harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, please, harvellandcollins.com. And with that, Cecil, Wes, I do appreciate this. You've opened some doors, I'm thinking, for further conversations. A fascinating concept about how a remainder trust works. I look forward to future conversations with you on this.
Okay. Thank you, Lockwood.
Thank you, Lockwood.
Harvell and Collins with us here on Let's Talk Legal.